The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, I'm delighted that we're joined by Nuala O'Connor and Diarmaid Farrelly to talk about the new documentary, feature-length documentary that they have made called Keepers of the Flame. Nuala has directed it. Diarmaid Farrelly wrote it with her. And it's very interesting, Diarmaid, because 1916, in some respects, was easy to commemorate in that there were straightforward heroes and villains and a very definite narrative. Keepers of the Flame is all about the War of Independence, the Civil War, and the survivors of that. Tell us what you want set out to achieve in Keepers of the Flame.
Well, I'd been hearing for years about this unopened archive, which was supposed to be the last big piece of the archival jigsaw relation to the revolutionary period. And it was finally released in the last couple of years. It's the archive of the military service pension
files. Yeah, you spoke to us about that previously on the programme.
And because they've been releasing it in tranches, and it's a massive archive. You're talking about in the region of 300,000 files. This is the archive that was generated by the applications of people who applied for pensions based on their War of Independence or Civil War service during that tumultuous period. And it's all the documentation that was generated as a result of their applications. There's a massive amount of detail in it. Not only outlining what they did or claimed to have done during the revolutionary period, but it also shines a light on what circumstances they find themselves in after the end of the Civil War. So you get a great insight into social history as well. So it really is a voluminous archive, and it's the single most important archive relating to the revolutionary period. That's how significant it is. And what we wanted to do was tell the story of that archive by looking at different themes and different individual family stories within that archive to illuminate these much wider themes, not just of the experience of the revolution and the aftermath, but also of memory and duties to memory and who are the people who remember and how do they do that.
Because, as I said there earlier, it's not just quite straightforward, is it, in the way like the 1916 rebellion is a straightforward story. There's all sorts of conflicting narratives.
Conflicting narratives, there are battles over recognition, over status, over whether claims that are made can be verified. There is strong class elements in it. There are battles in relation to women struggling to be heard or for their activities to be recognised. One of the key determinants in relation to pensions was whether people had active service. And even that
But what does that mean?
What does it mean? You know, active service means very different things for different people depending on what situations they found themselves in. So even deciding on what had been a contribution to the revolution was contested. And those who are overseeing this, the people in the Army Pensions Board, they're kind of arbiters in all sorts of disputes about recognition and about status. And the vast majority of people who applied for pensions were not successful. There was a memorandum in 1957 that indicated that 82,000 people had applied for pensions. 15,700 of them were successful. That means
that's an enormous amount who weren't successful. So how bitter were they about it all?
A lot of them were bitter, but a lot of them were quietly angry and could be very dignified with it. Most of them, of course, were handwriting these letters, some of them very impassioned letters. There's a whole variety of tones and sentiments. It's a very emotional archive.
Nuala O'Connor, what interested you in making a documentary about this?
It was stories about people, and I think that Diarmaid, the kind of material that he's always worked with, has been very focused on the experience of history as it is lived through. And with news rounds, you know, we see, say, the damage inflicted by war in Syria, in Iraq, in wherever. So we're looking at it on a 24-hour cycle. And this gives you a perspective on what impact those events had on people three generations removed.
Yeah, distance comes to mind because you talk about Iraq and Syria and play, there's a distance geographically which perhaps means that we don't focus on it.
True.
When you have a distance going back three generations as well, even if it is part of our Irish history and part of our inheritance, it often is something that's not talking about or even acknowledged.
No, and I think that not talking about was key. So there was very much a sense of something being uncovered. First of all, we have this archive, which, as Diarmaid has explained, is unique. That gives us a perspective. The time at which it was released into public access is significant. It almost stands as a commemorative piece in itself, if you like, a testimony to, because the files on people lasted as long as their lives lasted. So it, the files were constantly being updated. So if you got an increase in the pension, say 20 years down the road, you know, you would get correspondence from the pensions board. And then we've come across some quite funny things in the because it was a very bureaucratic system, so that you were constantly being asked questions about have your circumstances changed, because they were quite vigilant that anybody would, you know, be compliant.
If you started making money.
Money, correct.
This pension was taken away from you.
Or something like that, or reduced or aggregated with your income tax returns, whatever. But anyway, there's quite a funny letter to Margaret Pierce, who's in her 80s, I think. At this stage. From some whippersnapper in the pensions board, clearly, who knew nothing about the Pierces, because she's very, very irate. And says something in the letter, clearly you know nothing about my family, because the question on the form was, has your matrimonial situation changed? And she said, I'm hardly likely at this age, you know, whatever, brackets 82, to be in the marriage stakes, you know, that kind of thing. So you get little notes coming through, if you're there to be aware of them and hear them, that in fact this generation is now feeling that maybe they've been forgotten, overlooked. You know, that their hour has passed, and they're terrified they'll disappear into history.
And how did you document it? How do you make a feature-length documentary to hold the attention, perhaps in the absence of interviewees from the period and in the absence of relevant footage?
Good question. I just dived into the archive, basically, and spent a lot of time in there. Went through files. I had two things, I think. One was we wanted to talk to relatives, relatives who were identified with their family history in some way, in a kind of a human way, in that this is almost like oral tradition, what Granny told them, what Auntie Mary told them, what they picked up, what they found out from letters. Then they had looked at the archive file on their family as well. And the other thing was the letters themselves, which are so eloquent and so beautiful to look at. Because the handwriting of people those days was just like, I think as time goes on, we will look at those a bit like the hieroglyphics on the pyramids or something. Because it's these were children who had left school, say at sixth class, who had learned how to write with pen and ink, you know, a form of communication and actually handwriting. That doesn't exist anymore.
Okay, I want to play some clips from the documentary. This is one where Cecile Gordon, the project manager of the Irish Military Service Pension Project, tells why these archives are so important.
It's a tiny, tiny sliver of truths. It's just a reflection of reality, but it isn't the reality. It's a thin part of someone's life in a certain context at a particular time. Archives provokes emotional responses, and they're able to challenge big narratives, like a national narrative that's been transformed, politicized, all things you want, but family narratives as well, because myths are not just for the nation, they're in families. Some myths take hold because we have to go on. Memories get repressed because we have lives to build.
There was something else that just strikes me in relation to those who got the pensions, didn't get the pensions. Did a lot of it depend on whether they're on the winning side of the Civil War or not? Not that there really was a winning side when you think about it.
It did initially. I mean, the pensions process begins just after the Civil War. And at that stage, only those on the pro-treaty side of the Civil War need apply, because the Act does not apply to the irregulars, as they were known, the anti-treaty Republicans. But when Fianna Fáil come into power in 1932, that changes. And they extend the Act, having denounced it in the late 1920s. So there's constant reworking of the legislation and various amendments. You know, a lot of that is very technical. But they gradually increase the number of people who are eligible to apply, including women, the women who were incumbent a man as well. But there is that side of it, the bureaucracy. We have to be grateful in a way that officials were so assiduous and so careful about documenting absolutely everything, because it means that we just have this treasure trove now. But there is that hugely bureaucratic side to it. And many people found that difficult to navigate, particularly when they're having, you know, battles over years to get recognised for service. The pensions were graded A to E. E was the lowest grade. And it depended, again, on what you said you had done and what could be verified about your service between 1913 and 1923. And a lot of this is down to luck. in that some people make claims that can be verified by people who have survived, their senior officers, for example. Others are not so lucky, and it can be very difficult for them to find verification for what they claim they had done. So there's a lot of heartbreak in it. But you also see the disillusionment, the post-war, post-revolution disillusionment. This was not the way these people had imagined what the new Ireland would be like.
I want to play another clip because this Monk on McGann, who has been heard many times in this programme previously, he speaks about his grandmother. Who was his grandmother?
Sheila Humphreys was one of the best known Republican women of that era. And she was involved in a very intense way in Cumann na mBan.
What do you mean by intense now?
Intense in that, well, it's one of the issues that he addresses.
Well, let's hear him.
If the sporty kids in families, if my granny was the sporty kid, I was the opposite. I was the bookish, quiet kid who stayed at home, who wanted to talk to my granny. She'd tell about going up to Donegal on a skirmish and being given a gun, which we still had. She had this gun in a lovely sort of ormolu chest in her house. But we never, I never thought about the violence of it until later. I never thought about, wait there, in that attack in Aylesbury Road on her house, someone was killed. And I suddenly realised, wait there, this was a woman, she's telling us all these warm and exciting stories, but actually they were attacking people, they were shooting people. And again, it was only when I reached 20, 21 and I started getting into my own sort of new age, spiritual, you know, vague, nice ideas that I think, wait there, violence mightn't be the nicest idea. And if I have a granny who was actually, you know, a top markswoman and was willing to kill and might have actually killed people, then that's something I need to come to terms with.
And did she?
His granny was lethal.
Was she?
Well, you see, this is the thing, again, about there were all sorts of stories in the family, you know, about what she might have been involved in. And you can't always find...
You can't unpick
proof,
the myths.
But there was a story, which is true, which is that Ernie O'Malley did hide in the family home, that the home was raided by Free State soldiers. One of those very, very young, barely a week into the army, was killed in the skirmish in the house. And it isn't clear, according to the family story then, who shot him. And there's a question mark over, because Ernie apparently was not a good shot.
You see, and a lot of these things are left in abeyance, and there are a lot of silences. And sometimes people fill in those gaps with, you know, their own ideas or with lore or myth that has been handed down. One of the remarkable things about this archive is that I think a lot of private anguish is now becoming public property. This is a national archive. It belongs to us all. It belongs to the state on our behalf, or the state minds it on our behalf. And there are so many people over the last couple of years who have gone searching to find out if the stories that they have notions of in their family, or the threads that they may have been aware of, if they correspond to some of the documentation that's in the archives. And, you know, in some cases, trying to square circles. Sometimes they find that, you know, the family lore that was built up or passed down was hugely embellished or exaggerated. But sometimes they also find out that their grandparents are speaking to them through the letters in a way that they would never have spoken to them in person, because they didn't necessarily want to be either talking about these difficult things or else passing on perhaps some of the prejudices.
Dermot Farrater, thank you for joining us. Nuala O'Connor, when can people see Keepers of the Flame?
Well, it's showing in the Irish Film Centre at the moment at 6:30 every day for a week. It's also on in Dundrum, and it will be on television. I mean, it RTÉ co-commissioned it with the film board, so it will be transmitted sometime in the late spring on RTÉ.
It's also in Galway, in the cinema in Galway.
It is,
as well.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Nuala O'Connor, Dermot Farrater. Keepers of the Flame is the name of the documentary.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.